January 24, 1984. On the morning that he and his teammates completed the software for the Macintosh, Andy Hertzfeld had gone home exhausted and expected to stay in bed for at least a day. But that afternoon, after only 6 hours of sleep, he drove back to the office. He wanted to check in to see if there had been any problems, and most of his colleagues had done the same. They were lounging around, dazed but excited, when Jobs walked in. "Hey, pick yourselves up off the floor. We're not done yet," he announced. "We need a demo for the intro." His plan was to dramatically unveil the Macintosh in front of a large audience and have it show off some of its features to the inspirational theme from Chariots of Fire. "It needs to be done by the weekend to be ready for the rehearsals," he added. They all groaned, Hertzfeld recalled, "but as we talked, we realized that it would be fun to cook up something impressive." The launch event was scheduled for the Apple annual stockholders meeting on January 24th, 8 days away, at the Flint Auditorium of De Anza Community College. The television ad and the frenzy of press preview stories were the first two components in what would become the Steve Jobs playbook for making the introduction of a new product seem like an epical moment in world history. The third component was the public unveiling of the product itself amid fanfare and flourishes in front of an audience of adoring faithful mixed with journalists who were primed to be swept up in the excitement. Hertzfeld pulled off the remarkable feat of writing a music player in 2 days so that the computer could play the Chariots of Fire theme. But when Jobs heard it, he judged it lousy, so they decided to use a recording instead. At the same time, Jobs was thrilled with a speech generator that turned text into spoken words with a charming electronic accent, and he decided to make it part of the demo. "I want the Macintosh to be the first computer to introduce itself," he insisted. At the rehearsal the night before the launch, nothing was working well. Jobs hated the way the animation scrolled across the Macintosh screen, and he kept ordering tweaks. He also was dissatisfied with the stage lighting, and he directed Scully to move from seat to seat to give his opinion as various adjustments were made. Scully had never thought much about variations of stage lighting and gave the type of tentative answers a patient might give an eye doctor when asked which lens made the letters clearer. The rehearsals and changes went on for 5 hours, well into the night. He was driving people insane, getting mad at the stagehands for every glitch in the presentation, Scully recalled. "I thought there was no way we were going to get it done for the show the next morning." Most of all, Jobs fretted about his presentation. Scully fancied himself a good writer, so he suggested changes in Jobs' script. Jobs recalled being slightly annoyed, but their relationship was still in the phase when he was lathering on flattery and stroking Scully's ego. "I think of you just like Woz and Markala," he told Scully. "You're like one of the founders of the company. They founded the company, but you and I are founding the future." Scully lapped it up. The next morning, the 2,600-seat auditorium was mobbed. Jobs arrived in a double-breasted blue blazer, a starched white shirt, and a pale green bow tie. "This is the most important moment in my entire life," he told Scully as they waited backstage for the program to begin. "I'm really nervous. You're probably the only person who knows how I feel about this." Scully grasped his hand, held it for a moment, and whispered, "Good luck." As chairman of the company, Jobs went on stage first to start the shareholders' meeting. He did so with his own form of an invocation. "I'd like to open the meeting," he said, "with a 20-year-old poem by Dylan." That's Bob Dylan. He broke into a little smile, then looked down to read from the second verse of "The Times They Are A-Changin'." His voice was high-pitched as he raced through the 10 lines, ending with, "For the loser now will be later to win, for the times they are a-changin'." That song was the anthem that kept the multimillionaire board chairman in touch with his counterculture self-image. He had a bootleg copy of his favorite version, which was from the live concert Dylan performed with Joan Baez on Halloween 1964 at Lincoln Center's Philharmonic Hall. Scully came on stage to report on the company's earnings, and the audience started to become restless as he droned on. Finally, he ended with a personal note. "The most important thing that has happened to me in the last 9 months at Apple has been a chance to develop a friendship with Steve Jobs," he said. "For me, the rapport we have developed means an awful lot." The lights dimmed as Jobs reappeared on stage and launched into a dramatic version of the battle cry he had delivered at the Hawaii sales conference. "It is 1958, he began. "IBM passes up a chance to buy a young fledgling company that has invented a new technology called xerography. 2 years later, Xerox was born, and IBM has been kicking themselves ever since." The crowd laughed. Hertzfeld had heard versions of the speech both in Hawaii and elsewhere, but he was struck by how this time it was pulsing with more passion. After recounting other IBM missteps, Jobs picked up the pace and the emotion as he built toward the present. "It is now 1984. It appears that IBM wants it all. Apple is perceived to be the only hope to offer IBM a run for its money. Dealers, after initially welcoming IBM with open arms, now fear an IBM-dominated and controlled future and are turning back to Apple as the only force who can ensure their future freedom. IBM wants it all and is aiming its guns at its last obstacle to industry control, Apple. Will Big Blue dominate the entire computer industry? The entire information age? Was George Orwell right?" As he built to the climax, the audience went from murmuring to applauding to a frenzy of cheering and chanting. But before they could answer the Orwell question, the auditorium went black and the 1984 commercial appeared on the screen. When it was over, the entire audience was on its feet, cheering. With a flair for the dramatic, Jobs walked across the dark stage to a small table with a cloth bag on it. "Now I'd like to show you Macintosh in person," he said. He took out the computer, keyboard, and mouse, hooked them together deftly, then pulled one of the new 3.5-inch floppies from his shirt pocket. The theme from Chariots of Fire began to play. Jobs held his breath for a moment because the demo had not worked well the night before, but this time it ran flawlessly. The word Macintosh scrolled horizontally on screen, then underneath it the words "insanely great" appeared in script, as if being slowly written by hand. Not used to such beautiful graphic displays, the audience quieted for a moment. A few gasps could be heard, and then, in rapid succession, came a series of screenshots, Bill Atkinson's quick draw graphics package followed by displays of different fonts, documents, charts, drawings, a chess game, a spreadsheet, and a rendering of Steve Jobs with a thought bubble containing a Macintosh. When it was over, Jobs smiled and offered a treat. "We've done a lot of talking about Macintosh recently," he said, "but today, for the first time ever, I'd like to let Macintosh speak for itself." With that, he strolled back over to the computer, pressed the button on the mouse, and in a vibrato but endearing electronic deep voice, Macintosh became the first computer to introduce itself. "Hello, I'm Macintosh. It sure is great to get out of that bag," it began. The only thing it didn't seem to know how to do was to wait for the wild cheering and shrieks that erupted. Instead of basking for a moment, it barreled ahead. Unaccustomed as I am to public speaking, I'd like to share with you a maxim I thought of the first time I met an IBM mainframe. Never trust a computer you can't lift. Once again, the roar almost drowned out its final lines. Obviously, I can talk, but right now I'd like to sit back and listen. So it is with considerable pride that I introduce a man who's been like a father to me, Steve Jobs. Pandemonium erupted, with people in the crowd jumping up and down and pumping their fists in a frenzy. Jobs nodded slowly, a tight-lipped but broad smile on his face, then looked down and started to choke up. The ovation continued for 5 minutes. After the Macintosh team returned to Banley 3 that afternoon, a truck pulled into the parking lot and Jobs had them all gather next to it. Inside were 100 new Macintosh computers, each personalized with a plaque. Steve presented them one at a time to each team member with a handshake and a smile as the rest of us stood around cheering, Hertzfeld recalled. It had been a grueling ride, and many egos had been bruised by Jobs's obnoxious and rough management style. But neither Raskin, nor Wozniak, nor Scully, nor anyone else at the company could have pulled off the creation of the Macintosh. Nor would it likely have emerged from focus groups and committees. On the day he unveiled the Macintosh, a reporter from Popular Science asked Jobs what type of market research he had done. Jobs responded by scoffing. Did Alexander Graham Bell do any market research before he invented the telephone?